Welcome to Currents of Resistance here on WREK 91.1 FM. Currents of Resistance is brought to you each week by the Atlanta Independent Media Center. I'm your host, Warren Goodwin. With me in the studio is Daniel Rhodes. Tonight on Currents of Resistance, we're going to be interviewing Kathy Kelly, the co-coordinator of Voices in the Wilderness, a group that has worked for more than a decade to end the sanctions on Iraq and to aid the Iraqi people. Also worked very hard to try to prevent the Iraq War. We'd like to remind you, as always, that the opinions expressed here tonight are not necessarily those of WREK or the students and staff of Georgia Tech. And before we do the interview, we're going to have our headlines. So, a little bit of good news this week. In Washington, D.C., and this one's from the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center, people strike arrestees get justice in court. On September 27, 2002, 100 Pittsburghers headed to Washington, D.C. to participate in a national people strike, part of a protest against the policies of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. Others were there for a separate protest of the looming war in Iraq and the ongoing war in Afghanistan. Many were arrested preemptively while sitting peacefully in a park under orders given by Chief of Police Charles Ramsey in downtown D.C. Now the city of Washington, D.C., has acknowledged in an internal review that the arrests were illegal. The first wave of court cases arising from the illegal arrests has resulted in a settlement with the city of $7,000 per protester for a group of three student reporters swept up in the mass arrests. More than 400 protesters and bystanders were arrested in total, some of whom spent more than 24 hours in handcuffs to feet, handcuffed hand to feet and detained on a city bus on the floor of the district's Blue Plains Police Academy. And the Washington Post is suggesting that there might ultimately be a payout of about $4 million to the protesters whose civil rights were violated. Also, good news here in Atlanta, the Atlanta Bill of Rights Defense Campaign, after a nearly year-long struggle, has convinced the City of Atlanta's Atlanta City Council to pass the Civil Liberties Resolution, basically defending the civil liberties of Atlantans and in opposition to the USA Patriot Act. This makes Atlanta the 232nd community in the U.S. to take such action, and they are encouraging people to call Councilman Bozeman to thank him for pushing this bill through. I was there, and I can tell you that it passed unanimously with everyone voting for it, although it was a little bit of a watered-down version, somewhat, of the original version. So there's more information on that at the Bill of Rights Defense Campaign website, www.bordc.org. And we're going to take a little musical break, and then we'll be back with Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness. You're listening to Currents of Resistance.
Yo, this goes out to my man, Seth D. Yeah, I love, oh, love. Yeah. The free. I've been great, like a 15-inch subwoofer. Rattle the attic, collect from another hook, the hook off. Like a boxer in the ring off. Air and fire at you, wild for the sing off. You ice, like a rapper in the video. Remove the silhouette, now you looking silly though. I turn, like a mini-faced racist. Praise the Lord, and steady as an atheist. I'm massive, like an outstretched polar bear. Rappers, they feel me, girls think I'm teddy bear. She holds me, hugs me. Leaks the drama that she loves me. Vocal playing like rugby. I wanted her ugly, needed her ugly, treated her ugly. Look, she's very, very ugly. Sexing her ugly, calling her ugly, send her back ugly. Four, you black MCs, who's getting at these nuts? Starstruck on the uppity up. Chicks cockety club, I vanish. Like ounces out the bottle, you blemish. Like a bohemic model, I tarnish. Like a worn out athlete. Bring you back a freestyling on the corner street skills. You ain't got them like a newborn. Muse the bark on the ride like the Matterhorn. Now catch me, Jeep out Grand Cherokee. Hit the highway and you stir me. Living like, that's your life, the time of a scientist. Bucket stance like a praying mantis. Short in size, mentally gigantic. Best mechanic. The bridge. 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 The bridge.
All right, and you're listening to Currents of Resistance here on WREK 91.1. Can you hear me, Kathy? Kathy,
yes,
Kelly.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, hey. Daniel Rhodes is here with me. He's going to give you a little introduction for our listeners who are unfamiliar with your work.
Good evening. This is Daniel Rhodes from the Independent Media Center. We are here with Kathy Kelly, who is the founder of Voices in the Wilderness and also a member of the Catholic Worker. Good evening, Kathy.
Hello to both of you. Thank you for the invitation to be with you tonight.
Thank you.
Now, where are you speaking to us from, Kathy?
Well, I'm presently in Amman. I just arrived from Baghdad earlier today, and I'm in a small but very friendly hotel in the Abdali area of downtown Amman, Jordan.
Wonderful. And before we ask you any further question, we want to invite our listeners also to call in and ask questions. The phone number here is 404-894-2468. So, you know, we wanted to create a dialogue between the Atlanta community and you, Kathy. The first question that I have for you is basically in order to create a general understanding of the history of U.S. relations with Iraq. What was the social impact of the U.N. sanctions on Iraq?
The economic sanctions badly battered Iraq, and the most vulnerable people in Iraq, the elderly, the sick, the poor, and children, were the ones who suffered the most. I think it's arguable that Saddam Hussein never missed a meal. In fact, the sanctions strengthened Saddam Hussein's regime. But increasingly, as the unemployment rose, as education fell, as people couldn't get adequate access to food, to medicines, to any kind of purchasing power in their households, the quality of life deteriorated, and so many people that could get out did. Millions of their best educated left the country. So it was already a battered and badly, lethally punished country at the outset of the Bush administration, and it seemed as though President Bush wasn't very inclined to change the policies of the Clinton administration, a policy of waging economic warfare using the United Nations to do it. And then the U.S. was also bombing in the no-fly zones in the south and in the north of the country. There were so many violations of the United Nations Charter that two of the humanitarian coordinators in Iraq, Mr. Dennis Holliday and Mr. Hans von Spenick, after, in Dennis's case, 13 months, and so Hans von Spenick, 17 months, resigned from their posts. They said, no, we can't continue to work for the UN implementing a UN program that violates the UN Charter. Hundreds of thousands of children who had committed no crime died, and the world paid very little attention.
Were the
children under age 12.
The human impact, as you say, you know, was devastating, and I think it's important for people to realize the, you know, that 500,000 children died as a result of the UN sanctions. You mentioned that there was, you know, as we many people know, there was bombing in the no-fly zones. Were these no-fly zones populated with families and elderly?
Oh, yes, assuredly. I lived in the Basra area for the summer of 2000, and we would hear bombs that fell in civilian areas, but particularly in our neighborhood, there was a street called Missile Street, and one day on January 25th, 1999, a bomb that was supposed to hit a fertilizer plant missed, and believe me, this fertilizer plant is a good half-hour drive away from where the bomb struck, and that was on a civilian street, and it was a horrible day. People told of how they saw their children's body parts scattered on the street, particularly a woman named Haider, who in fact is with our group in Chicago now, lost her son Haider and her other son Mustafa, who's been in the United States for medical treatment now.
I'm very, very glad to
two of his fingers ripped off.
Yeah, many of the people who pay attention to the Independent Media Center probably remember we broadcast Greetings from Missile Street last year on our television show. So Haider is doing well and is touring the U.S. Is that what it sounds like you're saying?
Oh, no. She's just recovering from surgery herself.
Oh.
She's been such a wonderful presence to us, staying with us in Chicago. And she has done some speaking, but her child, Mustafa, was really a focal point for the time here. And He enrolled in a school while he was with us, and he's had dental care, and he's had some examination to find out whether or not the 106 pieces of shrapnel embedded in his backside might, in fact, be contaminated. There's so much research that needs to be done with regard to depleted uranium, and, of course, there's no treatment, but they were willing to undergo these tests. And so next week, they'll begin the journey back to Iraq.
That's good news that, you know, they can return to Iraq and persevere and struggle, you know, for human rights. You had mentioned that, you know, regarding the sanctions, you know, many people, especially the Bush administration, blamed Saddam Hussein, you know, for these sanctions and saying, you know, that because he violated, you know, UN rules, that it was, you know, it was required, it was necessary to impose the sanctions in order to try to weaken him. And my question is, you know, as far as the oil for food program that the U.S. That the U.S. made with the Saddam regime, did Saddam Hussein mismanage the oil for food program that may have increased the poverty and the disease in Iraq?
Well, I don't think that Saddam Hussein demonstrably cared very much about poverty and disease amongst the poorest of the poor in Iraq. I think his concerns were much more related to military development and being able to amass a fortune that would help him maintain power. And Saddam Hussein certainly wanted to be surrounded by an intelligence apparatus that would preserve his power. However, it's got to be recognized that the money that came from the oil for food program never went to Saddam Hussein. It went to a bank in New York City, the Bank of Paris, and the only people who were signatories to that account were United Nations workers. And as the oil revenue was invested in that bank, all that the Iraqis could do in order to be able to benefit from that revenue was submit contracts. Now, it normally took a year and a half for any contract to be fulfilled. So let's suppose they submitted a contract because they had to get needed medical supplies. Well, a year and a half later, they'd also have to hope that those medical supplies, A, arrived, and B, weren't expired, and C, could be evaluated and distributed. This is a very, very cumbersome way to try to run the healthcare system. And then you name the system, whether it was trying to keep the electricity maintained or the telephones maintained or agriculture or trade or education. Every system in the country was failing badly because these economic sanctions made it almost impossible to solve everyday problems and to get some purchasing power into the pockets of Iraqis so that they could pay the rent. You know, you can't just live with lentils and rice. The food ration consisted of lentils, rice, cooking oil, flour, salt, and tea. The people need more than that in order to live. They've got to buy shoes for their children. They've got to be able to do house repairs. They've got to get the car fixed when it breaks down. We know all this from our own lives. Iraqis are no different. It's a very sophisticated place in many of the cities. And in the cities, people increasingly became needy and desperate, and they were also subjected to a ruthless police state regime. But the sanctions, I believe, strengthened that regime.
Mm-hmm. Since the U.S. is responsible for so much death as a result of these sanctions, it's very ironic, when they claim that they are now trying to rebuild Iraq and build a better life. You would think that if they were sincere in doing so now, you know, that they would have attempted to do this in the 1990s. So my question is, what is your assessment of the U.S. reconstruction of Iraq? Have you seen any improvement, or has the economy and the social life actually disintegrated since the reconstruction began?
Well, I really appreciate your lead-in to that question because, you know, repeatedly, well, first of all, we were all told that there was basically only one person that lived in Iraq, yes, who is Saddam Hussein, but we were also repeatedly told that Saddam Hussein takes the money that should be spent on people who are poor and needy and spends it on the military. Okay, now look at what's happening in Iraq today. The United States, occupying powers, are taking money and resources that should be spent on rehabilitating a country so that the poorest of the poor and the economy widespread throughout the country can be once again restored to a livable future. And instead of spending the money on the poor, they're spending it on the military. When you go through Iraq, you see military vehicles, Humvees, APCs, helicopters, tanks, jeeps, every kind of military vehicle imaginable, U.S. military people, many of whom are just dying to get out of there, garbed in very expensive gear for protection, not very comfortable, I'm sure, but there's plenty of money being supplied for fuel to keep the U.S. military presence going. Then you can go to squalid neighborhoods where it's in cold weather right now, impossible for families to buy just the little bit of kerosene that it would take in order to fill a space heater. You find that families can't get access to clean water and electricity. The phones don't work. In a country so rich in oil, there are lines and lines and lines of cars waiting for gasoline, and the price of gas on the black market is astronomical, and many people can't wait in line all day for gas, so they do go out and get it on the black market. We find that people are so very frustrated because now, after 9 months, they haven't seen solutions to their problems. In fact, they're very anxious about civil war. There's no security on the streets. In the neighborhood that I lived in since just before Christmas, there were 3 major explosions, gunfire every night. Some nights, a terrible pounding. It sounded almost as bad as, in fact, one night, as loud and frightening as the height of the war. We were there during the occupation, I'm sorry, the Operation Shock and Awe. And so, you know, you're looking at people, I'm sure, coping with post-traumatic stress and wondering when is the relief in sight. And every family now can tell of some relative or maybe an immediate family member who underwent extreme abuse at the hands of occupying forces. Maybe they were hog-tied or kicked or beaten, or maybe they were basically kidnapped and taken off to a prison and people can't figure out where their loved ones are or what the charges might be. And so there's seething anger, you know, even to the point where I think the U.S. could be creating terrorists faster than the U.S. can kill them.
Mm-hmm. So it appears that with the lack of economic resources in Iraq for the Iraqi people, you know, their political rights are not being respected as well. Do you agree with that analysis? Do Iraqi?
Well, I think you might remember the Washington Post recently stated that Paul Bremer, who is in charge of the occupying forces, is the most powerful man to have ever been in an occupying country since General MacArthur.
Mm-hmm.
He is the ultimate power in Iraq today. If I had a problem that I wanted to try and help a family solve, for instance, if a family had a problem and I wanted to help them solve it, I would be told you have to go to Paul Bremer. There isn't a functioning constitution there, and we can even think of it. It took 13 years for the U.S. to get a constitution after the U.S. Revolution, but there isn't a functioning set of courts and judges. They've made appointments, but you know, right now, if a landlord decides that he wants to evict the family so that he can rehab a place, that family is on the streets, and there's no recourse. And the landlords know it. They're evicting families. They're raising the rent. Some of them are absentee landlords, so there's been a greatly exacerbated problem of homelessness. If somebody sticks a gun in your car window and says, "I'd like to have that car," you get out of the car and walk.
Mm-hmm.
People have no place where they can go with their problems. The policemen themselves are quite frightened. They congregate sometimes, you know, 40 of them all together at an intersection trying to look for protection from amongst one another. They're out there in their shirt sleeves with a Kalashnikov rifle, but they don't know if they might be the next to be attacked. There have been steady attacks on police stations, and I thoroughly disapprove of random violence. But, you know, you look at how well protected the U.S. soldiers are relative to these Iraqi police who are sitting ducks, and you wonder, is it force protection mainly for the American troops? Then, you know, the Iraqis start to ask, well, why are they there?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't they leave and give us back our country?
Mm-hmm.
So, but overall, do things seem to be improving? I mean, is there, you know, additional hours of electricity on each day? You know, are the gas lines getting shorter?
I would have to say that since I arrived on the 22nd of December, there has been an improvement in how much electricity we had. And there's also been an improvement in how long the lines for gas were. I counted 500 cars along one road, and that was before the road turned a bend, and I couldn't count anymore on December 23rd. And you don't see lines that would be more than a six-hour wait for gas now. But imagine if you needed to travel to Atlanta to get to your work, and you had to wait 6 hours in order to get gas in the tank. The schools have gotten nice paint jobs. Mm-hmm. All of the grade schools look quite good. They're painted green and white and red and white and blue and white. But they haven't gotten around to fixing the plumbing inside the schools or fixing the insulation so that rain won't come in and there won't be puddles on the floor. It won't be too cold and drafty. So we kind of say, well, nice paint job. And it seems that, I mean, if you send in well-trained military troops to do community development and conflict resolution, that's what you'll get. Mm-hmm. Well-trained military troops who've had almost no experience in community development and conflict resolution, who aren't paid to do that, who maybe don't understand too much about it, and you can't blame them, you're not going to get much of a solution. Money is being poured into both the military and also the pockets of major corporations such as Halliburton and Bechtel and Kellogg Brown and Root. But they aren't giving the jobs out, and certainly not the lucrative jobs, or even the low-paying jobs, to unemployed Iraqi people who, you have to admit, after 1991, got their electricity up and running within 6 months. So you can't tell Iraqi people that Saddam Hussein, after the 1991 war, when that country was blitzed with bombardments all throughout the country, and there were uprisings, and he was operating under sanctions, and he was a despised dictator. You can't tell Iraqi people that Saddam Hussein managed to get the lights working and get the bridges rebuilt and basically reconstruct as much as he could and do a better job than what these incredibly wealthy companies and the most powerful country on earth can accomplish.
Mm-hmm. So what do you accomplish the failure, the slow pace? I mean, is it corruption on the part of the Kellogg, Brown, and Root? Is it just, you know, not enough money, too much money for tanks, and not enough for plumbing? I mean,
Well, I think those two suggestions are a good start for trying to understand what's happened, right? That a lot of the funding has gone into the pockets of major corporations. There's a wonderful article explaining that by a young Filipino fellow, Herbert Dosena, and that was posted on our website earlier this week. I hope it's still up.
It is.
www.bitw.org. Oh, good. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, that the money is going so heavily into military, and that because of the attacks that have happened and the insecurity in the country, and that I would blame in part because the United States went in there with no plan for enabling mm-hmm. serious security within the neighborhoods. And after a government just suddenly disappears, I mean, can you imagine if all of a sudden in Atlanta, every jail and in Georgia, every prison had been emptied? That's what Saddam Hussein did in October of 2002. So a lot of those people shouldn't have been locked up, maybe most of them. But you do have a lot of criminals and thieves on the streets, okay? Imagine that. And then take out all the lights. Put the city in pitch dark and there aren't any phones working, and you've just gone through 4 weeks of steady bombardment following an anxiety of every day wondering, will the war begin today? Will it begin tomorrow? Your children are shell-shocked. There's no transportation functioning. None of the ministries where your passport or your identity papers, your driver's license, your health insurance papers, proof that you ever had an education, none of those are functioning, and many of them are burning. They're smoldering ruins. Now, into that situation, the U.S. Marines arrived, and there was no plan for how there would be a replacement of some semblance of protective measures, some semblance of governing authority. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a miserable nightmare. Some people said it was as though they awakened from one nightmare only to find that they had descended into another. And still, we don't find a workable plan being laid out for Iraq, and people are afraid that the next blow is going to be civil war.
Right, you mentioned that earlier. Could you elaborate on that? Who would be fighting who?
Well, because the United States government is now saying, I'm sorry, the coalition is moving toward decisions that would say, okay, you want more security, and we want to pull back troops because there's an election season coming up, and George Bush would do well to bring some troops home. So here's a solution that they're proposing. We help arm paramilitary groups from the Peshmerga in the north, which are Kurdish groups. Now, those Kurdish groups would have antagonism toward people who in their history had tortured or executed some of them. So it's hard to imagine they're just going to move into the center areas of the country and be welcomed. And they're supposed to work in coalition with another military called the Badr Brigade. And it's hard to imagine that the Sunni minority would accept the Shia Badr Brigade becoming a paramilitary. So you can see the divisions being set up and people with armaments being readied, and people are also now in the coalition talking about the possibility of forming a divided Iraq, divided between a northern, a central, and a southern area. Well, that would cut the center and the south off from the very valuable oil fields in the north, and also it would isolate the center from valuable oil resources in the south. And we could bet that the people who are mainly going to be controlling the petrodollars whenever that oil revenue does start to pick up would be the people with the financial institutions in the United States who just can't wait to grab up that income. So there's a great feeling of desire to change the situation before it rolls right over them. And I think that's part of what fuels insurgency now. That's part of the reason why people don't give support to the occupying forces. Part of the reason why perhaps they're not going to prevent or intervene, prevent violence from happening to either people who are occupying soldiers or those seen as collaborators, or they're not going to intervene if they see people doing things that would undermine the occupation. Now, I myself am never going to say that it's right to pick up a gun and use the gun to shoot and kill in order to solve a problem. But I do want to say that the main example given by the United States has been one of reliance on threat and force and fear and terror.
Thank you very much, Kathy Kelly, for answering our questions and, you know, having a dialogue with us about the current situation in Iraq.
Do you have any final suggestions for, you know, what people here in the U.S. should be doing to try to improve the situation over there in Iraq?
Well, just what you two have done. It's clear you've educated yourself about a lot of important questions, and I hope that people will continue to hold educational events and then call your senators and representatives and say, look, we've educated ourselves about this, and we're not ready to accept what we're seeing in mainstream media. We think that there are more questions that need to be raised. And if your representative makes a trip to Iraq for 2 days and comes back and says, oh, now I've seen the light, you know, there maybe needs to be a little more examination of the history and the context. I think it's also a wonderful opportunity, really, to help some of the people that are wrongfully imprisoned. I went to the Umm Qasr prison in southern Iraq and met with four young Palestinian students who've been imprisoned since April 9th. It's been a terrible ordeal for them. They're being held without a clear charge, just waiting to see if release papers might come through. Even the U.S. military officials in the prison tent camp, a miserable spot, said that they recommended release. But I guess the bureaucracy is slow. Well, these young guys have lost a year of their lives as students, and they're beginning to feel quite bitter, I think. So if anyone would like to help with speeding up the release of some of these detainees, mm-hmm. third country nationals who are not convicted or even accused of any crime as far as we can tell, we'd like to help with that along. Again, our website is www.bitw.org. I'll be back in Chicago myself on Thursday night, and we're very ready to start to circulate information about the names and serial numbers, prison numbers for these youngsters, and people could make calls to their elected representatives. We also encourage people to think not only about rebuilding Iraq, but rebuilding ourselves. How do we change our culture so we're not so addicted to war? For me, it's meant not paying taxes.
Yeah.
And we're cooperating with warfare.
Thank you very much, Kathy Kelly. I'm sorry we're running up against the end of our show. You've been listening to Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices in the Wilderness. As she said, their website is www.vitw.org. Encourage you to go there for more information. And we have room for just one event announcement here on our community calendar, and that is this Friday, January 9th at 8 p.m., Uncovered, The Truth About the Iraq War will be presented by Atlanta Indie Media and WRFG 89.3 FM at the Little Five Points Community Center, 1083 Austin Avenue in Little Five Points. And as always, you can give us a call at currentsofresistance@wrak.org.